We got some 3-0 and 3-1 series comebacks potentially brewing. Tom Habershaw and I start off the show talking about those. Then we hit every other series still going on in the playoffs, the ones that are over, and then the NBA's new draft lottery reform proposal. We dive deep into that at the end of the show. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. NBA playoffs are going crazy. To talk about it all, Tom Habershaw. Tom, what's up? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Bopping. That was awesome. Is this new music, KOC?
That is some new music. We did have some new music there. Farewell to Father John Misty. I still love you very much, but we do have the new music for the remainder of the playoffs here, Tom. We got a lot to talk about because there are some brewing comebacks in the NBA playoffs. We got the Rockets, the Pistons, the Sixers, the Nuggets, now down 3-2 after they were down either 3-0 or 3-1. And let's start off with the once what was a 3-0 series. Rockets-Lakers. Rockets win 99-93 and force a game six. And I want to start off with this one, Tom, with something personal to us, but also I think it sums up the series. Reed Sheppard hit a clutch pull-up mid-range jumper down the stretch of the game, ending an 11-1 run by the Lakers. And then on the other end of the floor, LeBron ran a pick-and-roll. Reed Sheppard just flew in there, stole the ball, went on the break, and dunked the ball in. And I think this sequence sums up the two wins in a row for the Houston Rockets, where you have these young guys getting comfortable. Reed Sheppard, who pissed down the side of his leg when LeBron James put full court pressure on him earlier in the series, now coming up big. Amen Thompson hitting two clutch three-pointers. Jabari Smith Jr., 22 points, looking like Aaron Gordon, hitting big shots, rebounding, playing great defense. Alperen Şengün forcing double teams, picking apart the defense. So you have that side of it with the young guys getting comfortable. And then the defense, the Reed Sheppard steal, is symbolic of what has been the Rockets defense ramping up the pressure in game four. I called it out on Monday's show, and it happened again in game five, holding the Lakers to 96 points in game four, 93 points in game five, forcing sloppy turnovers, Tom. Houston is giving themselves a real shot here. They have flipped the story of the series after going down 3-0, making this 3-2. What are you seeing from this Rockets defense, them just suffocating this Lakers offense with 96 and 93 points in the last two games?
Yeah, LeBron sounded so dejected after that loss because I think he knows what stands in front of him is he's the oldest guy in the NBA, the oldest guy we've seen in a long time competing at 41 years old in the playoffs, going against the youngest team, the youngest starting five to ever win a playoff game. That stat from ESPN, when you're talking about a starting five where only Tari Eason was alive for the Sports Illustrated cover with the chosen one, LeBron James Sports Illustrated cover. We're talking guys who are 21, 22, 23, 24 years old, going against a veteran team where Marcus Smart and LeBron James ran out of gas down the stretch, and they were responding to a Houston Rockets team that I think if you're going to pull off a 3-0 comeback, the rally from 3-0, you have to have a certain level of like naivete, a certain level of like, I don't care. We're going against history. I wasn't alive for any of these stats, the history of this sport coming back from 3-0. And it would be the first one since I think a couple years ago, Boston Celtics coming back against the Miami Heat and succumbing in game seven, the last time we saw this with a team down 3-0 and forcing a game seven. I think this Houston Rockets team is very much in the conversation for being in this hallowed place in history. It would be the first time that we've ever seen a team come back from 3-0 and win it, given the fact that they're going to potentially have Kevin Durant. I'll note here that ESPN Shams Charania mentioned this morning that Kevin Durant is already out for game six. That is bad news for the Houston Rockets, considering, well, if you want
is
him
it
back.
Tom? No, is it, yeah, is it bad? I mean, like, seriously, I mean, the Rockets right now look comfortable with this unit right now. In some regards, Kevin Durant slows things down, makes them a little bit easier to game plan against. I look at it very similarly to the Celtics-Sixers series where Embiid raises their ceiling but also lowers their floor. I feel like that's sort of the case right now with Houston. I think offensively they became a little bit less dynamic. They raised their ceiling, of course, because KD's KD. He can still shoot the lights out. But defensively, they are just flying around. That's what's fueling this. Yep. It is defense. They are flying around, doubling, full court pressure, like the Reed Shepherd steal where he just jumps the pick and roll, perfect hand-eye coordination to get that ball. It's a lot of that. It's Amen Thompson coming out of nowhere. They're making the Lakers look disjointed in the half court. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Durant, like, it's not that he can't help that, but if he's coming back from an extended rest, he's older, 37 years old. I would have concerns about it impacting Houston's energy, which I think is the fuel behind this comeback right now.
Yeah, and I'm so proud of our son, Reed Shepherd. He's coming out here and he's showing he's got great hands defensively. He doesn't have the size that you need to be an elite defensive player. But in terms of stripping the ball, blocking shots, like, he has always shown that the ability to rack up a lot of stocks out there with his hands, and the defensive play there against LeBron, a guy that, you know, kind of, like you said, just terrorized him when he had that full court pressure. And you saw in this game, the ability to get into the paint, make plays for others. They need so much of that downhill attack and that three-point shooting. There's a big reason why when he's on the floor, the Houston Rockets have 110 offensive rating, and it crashes when Reed Shepherd's not out there. I mean, who would have thought that a guy who's one of the best shooters in the league, and yes, he's only 21 years old and years away from his prime, but I think there's a reason why you're seeing a lot of this feistiness down the stretch with Reed Shepherd the last couple days. And Jabari Smith said it after the game. They're growing up. They got a lot of growing up to do over the next couple games here to try to close this out against the Lakers team with Marcus Smart, LeBron James. But that defense, that has been the hallmark of this Houston Rockets team. Without Steven Adams, without Fred VanVleet and Kevin Durant, they have to continue to lock down and win on that end of the floor. Because offensively, man, it's really tough when you got Amen Thompson out there and the youth on this team. It's just going to be coming a real steel cage match against LeBron James and Marcus Smart. And without Marcus Smart hitting those threes and having that, and LeBron not hitting his threes, this Lakers offense looks incredibly one-dimensional, and you saw that even with Austin Reeves.
You mentioned LeBron James not hitting his jumpers. That's one of the stories of the series for sure. I mean, Austin Reeves comes back and he gets to the line a lot, 12 for 13. He helped provide a spark early, but you do need LeBron to not be 28% from three, 36% from mid-range. After games one and two, we talked about how, oh, LeBron looks like he can play till he's 50, you know, back to the basket, scoring at will. Well, he looks his age at the last couple of games against the Rockets. The shot has not been there really all season long after he seemingly was shooting better than ever a couple of years ago. And he had an air ball in this series. He had a shot just brick off the side of the backboard. He's missing short on basically everything. I think he looks tired out there considering how much he's missing short on the outside of the rim. It's not like these are rattling out, you know, close misses. These are pretty clear, definitive short misses in many cases. Look, LeBron is extraordinary. The fact he's still doing what he's doing at his age, but it feels like Austin Reeves needs to repeat what Embiid did in the Celtics Sixers series, where Embiid's first came back, looked rusty, didn't look like full Joel Embiid. And then game five to force a game six, Embiid looked more like the MVP Joel Embiid. Austin Reeves, similar thing. He looked good to start this game. I posted on X. I said, oh, like, Austin Reeves looks like he didn't miss any time. It did look like he missed time as the game went on, probably as fatigue started building up. And now he's only got one day of rest. This older Lakers squad only has one day of rest. Reeves, just coming back from an injury, needs to get ready for Friday. And that's a lot to ask from a guy who missed so much time. Look, we have never seen a 3-0 comeback completed in the history of basketball, Tom. It has never happened. If it happens this, for the first time, what did you?
This
grab
right
that?
Here is my ticket stub, KOC.
Oh,
that's my ticket stub from Game 3 of the 2004 ALCS.
Wow!
I keep it with me. at all times to remind myself that no matter how cowboy bad things up. Get, you can always you cowboy up. That's right. When no matter how bad things get, you know, they can turn around. And so it is. I went to that game and I remember Red Sox fans, grown men were crying in the bleachers because it's just the vibes have never been lower, Kev, than game three of the 2004 ALCS when they won, the Yankees won 19-8, reminding all the Red Sox fans that it had been since 1918 that they won a World Series. And so it would be, you know, I mentioned a couple years ago that the Celtics almost came back and did it again in Boston. So the history has not been kind. We've seen, I think, in the last 20 years, the last time before the Celtics forced a game seven was 2003 in the Western Conference first round. Dallas went up 3-0. The Blazers came back and forced a game seven. In Arvydas Sabonis' final game of his career, Dallas ultimately won on their home floor. So you haven't seen this, even like a game seven, getting into a game seven, really more than once in the last 20 years. So what's up against the Rockets is incredibly tough. But I mean, again, like the youth is on the side of this Houston Rockets team, and they have the ability, I think, with that defense, like you mentioned, and the low number of threes that the Lakers are generating. It came back to bite them in this game where Kennard was not getting off. And that's the thing is, like, it was really cool to see the Luke Kennard show the first couple games of the series, but they're going to need so much more of that. They only had one corner 3-point attempt in that entire game last night. And on the other side, Houston Rockets had 15 attempts from the corner, which is kind of like the canary of the coal mine of good offense, is when you're drawing defenders and able to kick out to the corners, that's a good sign of healthy offense. You just didn't see that from the Lakers.
I think that's spot on, Tom. There's a math problem on the Lakers side of things. And we talked about it early in the series when the Lakers were up and Luke Kennard scoring 25 points a night and Marcus Smart has 20. And I said, well, they can't rely on this to continue moving forward in the series. And well, hey, Amen Thompson has turned the water off for Luke Kennard. He had 1 point in game five, just a complete non-factor, basically unplayable. Marcus Smart can't get anything going, throwing sloppy turnovers all over the floor. It feels like to me, the Rockets know he's not looking to score inside the arc, and they are really playing him one-on-one, looking for the passes, and Smart has made some, you know, not so smart decisions at all. So for the Lakers, I'm very worried. Like I chuckle at the thought of LeBron James being on the side of the first 3-0 comeback in NBA history. If that happens, I mean, the way this was building, Tom, with the Lakers up 3-0 and KD not on the bench and KD unable to play, it was building towards, oh, this is the story of their careers. LeBron elevating these teams with these misfits and KD not able to elevate his rosters. And then if it turns into this, LeBron blowing a 3-0 lead.
It's the ultimate test, man. It's the ultimate test whether you're a LeBron supporter or a LeBron hater, because yes, the LeBron supporters are going to be like, he's 41 years old. Everyone's retired and in Cancun by now, and he's going to get penalized for being the only healthy guy on the Lakers going into this series. And so
Jordan didn't even make the playoffs. Jordan never even made it with the Wizards. At least he made the playoffs. Just like he made the finals. He didn't lose in the first round. He made the finals.
It's going to be another LeBron culture war for sure if this happens. Yeah. And it's going to be, to think that, like, LeBron, he didn't sign up for being part of this, like, no Luka, no Austin Reeves in this series against the Houston Rockets. And yes, KD being out certainly changes things and certainly hurts the Rockets in the long run. But you're right. If he is able to be like 50% for game seven, I don't think the Houston Rockets want that. I think the way, if you're forcing a game seven, that means there's chemistry, momentum, there's something they found with this group, this young group. And if you don't have like an 80 to 90% Kevin Durant for game seven, I'd be surprised if he comes back.
Yeah, I'd be a little surprised there too. So we have that as a potential 3-0 comeback. We have a series of 3-1 potential comebacks as well. Let's start out with the Pistons Magic. They played on Wednesday night. Pistons won this game 116-109, forcing a game six. And this was an epic back and forth duel between Cade Cunningham and your favorite player, Paolo Banchero. 45 points for each of them. Cade on 13 of 23. Paolo on 45 points on 17 of 31. No Franz Wagner. Banchero kept them in that game aside from some of his weird, uncharacteristic missed free throws. But Cade, after what has been, you know, up and down postseason, he was averaging 29 points per game. He was getting buckets. But he had 24 turnovers over games 2, 3, and 4, the most over a three-game stretch in NBA playoff history. He was making a lot of sloppy mistakes. And I think in this game, Tom, I mean, he did hit a couple threes, but Cade, to me, the big adjustment that he made, I posted about this after game four. I said, I can't understand why Cade Cunningham insists on taking so many threes off the dribble. At the time, he was 10 of 18 on mid-range pull-ups, only 6 of 24 from three. He did flip that in game five. If you look at his shot distribution in each game,
oh yeah,
game one, 18% of his shots came from mid-range. Games two and three, 26%. Game four, up to 30%. And game five, up to 39% of his shots came from mid-range. He's now making 58% of his shots from mid-range compared to 31% of his threes off the dribble. Cade got where he wanted, and I felt like that starting with the mid-range opened everything up for him and also led to the dagger at the end.
Oh, totally. And you knew that shot was going in as soon as he got to his spot. And you're absolutely right. Cade Cunningham in the playoffs, when you got like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he's figured this out too, is if you can get to that shot, it's a layup for these guys. It's not for Paolo Banchero, even though he came out in this game and was outrageously effective and efficient. But there's a lot of guys that can get to the mid-range, but there's only a few that it's a layup. And Cade Cunningham's one of those guys. He's so tall and strong, and he's got great footwork and deceleration that a lot of times if he slams on the brakes, he's able to get that shot off. And with those legs, we're seeing it with Jokic, we're seeing it with LeBron, is if your legs aren't underneath you or you're fatigued or you're not 100%, those three-point shots are so much harder. And it's a big reason why I think even if you're not getting to the cup, the Magic are loading up the paint and daring Jalen Duren and Cade Cunningham to try to force a shot at the rim on an acrobatic play, and he's able to get to his spots. Look, it's too bad for Paolo Banchero, because I think this was one of the best games of his life in the NBA, and he could not finish at the free throw line, but he had his three-point shot going, especially late in this game where he was rising up confidently from downtown and getting those shots. But Cade Cunningham, with that mid-range, it is so tough to beat. And a reason why low turnover, get to your spots, the mid-range is back in the NBA in the playoffs. It never left in the playoffs. In the playoffs, it's still such an important shot. And for Cade Cunningham, you're seeing I think him realizing that, yeah, getting into that paint and having an open, a good look at the shot at the rim at 10 feet away, that's what you want.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. Cade, credit to him for making adjustments. I wrote a story on Yahoo Sports in the middle of the week about how, hey, you know, maybe the Magic have exploited that Cade isn't a true number one, and he's more like a number two or a 1B, that the Pistons don't just need shooters, but they need another co-star by his side. Well, hey, Cade Cunningham sure did answer with 45 points in that game, cutting down on his turnovers. He was absolutely amazing. I think for the Pistons, I mean, the Magic, they really are the zombie Magic. Like, they just kept coming and coming. It felt like every time the Pistons had a chance to pull away, the Magic kept coming back. And that was despite not having Franz Wagner. Wagner out with a calf strain for game five. He played only 24 minutes in game four, even though the Magic were able to win that game still, that game four. Look, Cade was unbelievable in game five. Franz Wagner has been the best defender on him in the series. And if the Magic aren't able to get Franz Wagner back, or Franz Wagner is not able to be healthy, that changes the whole dynamic. And I think it sets up for the possibility that Cade could have another big game, either in a game six or in a game seven, possibly to win it for Detroit, or it sets up the possibility that Orlando is going to have to send even more attention to him creating even more opportunities for others. Now, that has been a thing already in the series with Orlando packing the paint, with help coming in, not worried about Ausar Thompson, not even worried about Tobias Harris, who was shooting below 20% from three entering game five. But I think you could see a little bit more of that, Tom, if Cade continues thriving, getting where he wants, getting to the basket, drawing free throws, getting to his mid-range. It seemed like Cade made the proper adjustments in this game, and I feel more confident in Cade having another 45-point banger than I do in Paolo Banchero having another 45-point game without Franz Wagner out there to help carry the slack, carry it for Orlando either.
I think Stan McGundy was absolutely right. Is he surprised that they're not doubling Cade Cunningham, forcing the ball out of his hands? Because every time down the stretch last night, it was the Tobias Harris show, and I'm just scratching my head like, this is the year 2026, and there's a 60-win team in the NBA relying on Tobias Harris to create something out of thin air. And it's so apparent that the roster is flawed in those moments when Cade gets rid of the ball, and then the offense dies. It completely combusts when he doesn't have the ball down the stretch. And so I suspect that Jamal Mosley is going to review the film and realize they have to double Cade every time he touches the ball and force the rock to go to Ausar Thompson or Tobias Harris. I don't know where Caris LeVert is, because that's kind of why they brought him in here, is without Malik Beasley, they need someone to create anything offensively. And now it's like Tobias Harris is just a deer in headlights in the stretch. Be like, wait, am I at 33 years old supposed to be the number two scorer on a title contending team? And that's the reality. Jalen Duren hasn't stepped up, and we haven't seen it from other guys. This is really the Cade Cunningham show, and I think Jamal Mosley needs to shut it down by doubling him every time he gets the ball in game six.
I think you're hitting on it, Tom. Like, they are sending attention to Cade late, right? That's what they were doing throughout the series, packing the paint. But they're not sending double teams early, and I think that's where the shift might happen. That's one card they haven't pulled yet in this series, because they haven't had to. They were up 3-1, and they're still up 3-2. But I do think there's a real possibility that's exactly what we see in this game six, is early doubles on Cade Cunningham, different than what we've seen prior. Will that work? Not necessarily. I mean, Harris did have 23 points in game five. He was 9 of 18. He was pretty solid. Ausar Thompson, he doesn't score a lot. He has only 6 points, but he's a really good slasher. If you're finding Ausar Thompson with a head of steam out of a short roll, able to drive into the paint, it could create problems for the Magic. So no guarantees that will work, but I do think we'll see something like that. And speaking about Ausar Thompson, how cool is it, Tom, to see Amen Thompson and Ausar Thompson both just making so many winning plays every single moment they're on the floor? These guys are flying around. They're grabbing loose balls. 15 boards for Ausar Thompson in that game against the Magic, the game five. Amen Thompson even hit 2 clutch 3-pointers, and those were like back-breaking threes. Like, they're not worried about Amen Thompson spotting up in the corner. Yep. The Lakers weren't, and he just drained those threes. These kids can't shoot. Well, except for those shots by Amen Thompson.
Yeah, those are so big, dude. Yeah.
But they're winners, dude. They just win, both of these guys. I love them. I love the Thompson twins.
Yeah, they're so fun to watch. They're so unpredictable, right? Like, anytime they're on the floor, the ability to close speed, close distance, and they can make so many plays. Like, I watched Matisse Thybulle all season long, where he's able to close out space in ways that you can't even, he's kind of like a, he transports somehow. It's the same thing with the Thompson brothers, where it's like, how do they get to that spot? How do they get to that rebound? And there was that one highlight where Ausar Thompson was able to jump from a standstill and dunk the ball, where it's just like, I don't know how these guys, Amen Thompson Flubber Kawhi, just because he's just got this ability to bounce around in ways that it doesn't seem physically possible for these brothers to do it. And so, yeah, they're 23 years old, and we've got a whole, you know, another 10 years of these guys just blowing our minds in the playoffs. So I'm excited to see it.
Look, if either of them or both of them can figure out how to become consistent three-point shooters, these guys are going to be on all NBA teams every single year of their careers. Yeah. If they figure out the three, because they got everything else. That's why Amen Thompson, I thought he was the defensive player of the year last year. He was an all-NBA, all-defensive guy. That's why Ausar Thompson finished top three in defensive player of the year this year and will be a first-team all-defensive player as well. They already have that end of the floor and all the other stuff, the dirty work stuff figured out. The other series, potentially, with a 3-1 comeback, is Celtics-Sixers. Sixers forced a game six, destroying Boston the other night. I mean, it was really, you know, a tale of the two sides of the coin here with Joel Embiid. Joel Embiid comes back in game four, looks sluggish and slow, hurting their offensive flow. He looked lost on defense. And then in game five, the Sixers changed things up. They changed up their defense by having Embiid sag lower in pick and rolls by Boston. They kept him close to the paint. That really, I thought, discombobulated the Celtics defense throughout the entire game, in addition to the fact Philly was going over these ball screens, forcing Tatum out of these easier open pull-up three-pointers. That's what you want. You don't want drive and kick opportunities. And Boston, in this game, Tom, if you watch some of these shots that Boston takes, they're getting covered very closely on these catch-and-shoot opportunities. Boston in game five had only 20 catch and shoot threes in the game. That's a series low for them. Game one, they had 25, then 38, then 33, then 33, and then down to 20. Their season average was 27 catch and shoot three-pointers per game. Philly's defense was the cause of that by preventing a lot of drive and kick opportunities, staying home on those Boston shooters. Do you think Mazzulla and the Celtics will be able to cook up an adjustment for this entering game six, or do you think Philly may have figured something out here with Joel Embiid back in the defense they're now playing?
Yeah, very interesting how they were terrified to go at Joel Embiid down the stretch in this one. They were 1 of 14 on 2-point shots in that disgusting fourth quarter. Wow. 1 of 14, and only two of those came at the rim. So they were playing in that mid-range, uncomfortable area for them. And Peyton Pritchard, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, these are guys that, yes, they can hit a mid-range shot, and they have shown the ability to be efficient in that in-between zone. But in this spot, it looked like they were tentative, and the Sixers were making it very uncomfortable for them with Embiid. And on both ends of the floor, Embiid looks so, you forget how massive this guy is when he's lining up against Vucevic and Kata and whomever the Celtics are going to be able to throw at him. It's on both ends of the floor. It looked like the Celtics were afraid of Joel Embiid and didn't have an answer for him. And it's evidenced by that god-awful shot distribution in that fourth quarter where they were just completely uncomfortable. And we say this a lot in the analysis of the three-point era. Defenses can control three-point volume. They cannot control whether it goes in. Time and time again, we see the studies that show it's a make-or-miss league, but what you can do is try to lower the opportunities of them taking those threes, and that's what you saw with the Sixers. For the first time in years, they took more threes than the Boston Celtics, and that's very unusual in this series, but it shows that Nick Nurse found something, and the Joel Embiid factor looms large in Game 6, potentially here, moving to a Game 7. That three-point shot variance, you wonder if the Celtics clam up and continue to clam up here as we get deeper into this series, because I really do think they found something, the Sixers, in that Game 5 win.
I mean, it's, you know, a very simple thing to say, but with Boston, it really does come down to the three-pointer. They embody, live by the three, die by the three. And this entire season, during the regular season, they were 27-0 when they shot 40% or higher from three. Yes. They were 41-6. At just 35% or higher, 41-6, they were 15-20 when they shot under 35%. And then in the playoffs, they are 3-0 when they shot 35% or higher from three. They are 0-2 when they shoot under 35%. So Boston is basically on a 72-win regular season pace when they just merely shoot 35% or higher from three. It is a simple thing to say, well, if Boston just hit shots, they win the game. In some ways, it's true, Tom. But I think you hit the important point here. It's Philly influencing the amount of threes that they're taking. And I think still, even if Boston does shoot better, it's not like they're immune to losing. Like they still need to win some of these one-on-ones and two-on-twos and pick and roll. Tatum needs to be more efficient in getting into that mid-range, driving into Embiid, getting into the paint, finding kick-out opportunities or drawing fouls or scoring himself. And then Jaylen Brown in this game, he was bottled up by Paul George. George was unbelievable defending Jaylen Brown in this game. It looked like vintage PG against Jaylen Brown. And I think that's a big part of it too. If Jaylen Brown has a hard time continuing to go one-on-one against George, that's one of those battles that Philly won to force a game six and will have to win again to force a game seven. I'm not ruling it out. I still think the Celtics win this series, but Embiid playing the way he did in game five and George playing the way he did, knowing what Maxey and Edgecombe are capable of doing, you cannot rule out Philly actually winning this series and moving on to round two.
Yeah, let's give some credit to Paul George. Like you said, amazing defense against Jaylen Brown in game five, but also throughout the series, this is why they got Paul George, is they knew they were going to have to face the Boston Celtics with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and he is the perfect defender for both of those guys. And you mentioned the defense against Jaylen, but also Tatum. Paul George in this series, when he's guarding Tatum, Tatum's shooting just 8 of 23 with 5 assists and 4 turnovers, according to the NBA's player tracking data. And he's got the size and he's got the legs beneath him. You know, you mentioned it. 25-game suspension for Paul George, the long time sitting out for Paul George, has actually helped him have those fresher legs here in the postseason. Give a shout out to VJ Edgecombe, another defensive game where he had a nice block on Jason Tatum at the end of this game. And just the defense you're seeing from Tatum, it feels like, you know, this Paul George, the athleticism of Edgecombe, this is a 76ers team that doesn't feel afraid of this moment. They could have just laid down when Joel Embiid was having the appendicitis and out with that affliction. But instead, here it looks like they've got the momentum in this series. They're playing great defensively, and it looks like the Celtics are the ones that are uncomfortable, and it's the 76ers who look like they have the upper hand in this series. But of course, 3-2 series, Boston's favor. It's going to be an uphill climb.
Yeah, absolutely will be. And look, Boston might just have a night where they shoot 44% from three and they become 30-0 on the regular season and in the playoffs this season when they shoot over 40%. That's very possible that that's just what happens in game six, and it's over. And we'll be right back after this break. The other series that could move on to a game seven with a 3-1 comeback is Minnesota versus Denver. Obviously, this series is a little bit of a different feel with Anthony Edwards out, with the knee issue, and Dante DiVincenzo rupturing his Achilles. Game five feels like it was a century ago with everything that's happened this week in the NBA. We'll talk about the new draft lottery stuff later in the show. We'll talk about the series that ended as well as the other series too, but Monday feels like a century ago with Denver winning that game to make it 3-2. Now game six is tonight, Tom. What do you think is the key for Minnesota to finish off this series, end it, don't risk going to a game seven?
It's going to have to take a Julius Randle all-time performance here, because now we're seeing, according to the Minnesota Timberwolves injury report, that Ayo Dosunmu is questionable with calf soreness, and Bones Highland also questionable. Might be gamesmanship. He might be, you know, more probable than necessarily questionable, and they just want to throw a wrench in Denver's scouting report. But it also, you don't want to see that injury if you're the Minnesota Timberwolves, where they're already down Dante DiVincenzo and Anthony Edwards. It's going to come down to Julius Randle. He dominated the Golden State Warriors last year in the postseason and was a lot more consistent. He had a nice game five, but in order to beat this Denver Nuggets team that is dealing with Aaron Gordon not as healthy as he wants to be, and the fact that Nikola Jokic, without that kind of help side baseline defender, Julius Randle's just got to go bully ball. And he's got to be able to assert himself and have a 30, 35 point night to minimize or to basically make this essentially a Julius Randle opportunity here, because the offense is going to be so hamstrung by these injuries on the Minnesota side. We know Jokic is going to have some issues going against Rudy Gobert like he's had all season long. It seems like he got a little bit loosened up in that Game 5 win. But Julius Randle, it's going to be on his shoulders. And I know that sentence is kind of scary, but your team needs an all-time performance from Julius Randle if they want to stave off the Denver Nuggets.
I think we're thinking very much along the same lines. The Io Dosunmu news is definitely scary. He was downgraded today on game day. It might be gamesmanship, as you said, but perhaps not. And let's just say Dosunmu is out or limited, or even if he does play and he's fine. You still need some variables to go your way. Julius Randle having a big night is one of them. I wonder if you'll see just crashing the offensive boards more often as well with Gobert and Randle, Naz Reid trying to create second chance opportunities more than you have throughout the series as well, just making it messy, getting second chances, put back opportunities. Because without Anthony Edwards, you're not going to get those traditional pick and roll Gobert finishing on the roll as often. You're going to need to make it messy. But I also wonder, let's just say Dosunmu was limited. You're going to need somebody besides Julius Randle to handle the ball. Jaden McDaniels is the guy who's done it a little bit in the past. Will they try to get Jaden McDaniels more on-ball scoring opportunities? And if they do that, will that require him moving off of Jamal Murray so he's not just expending so much energy fighting over those ball screens and those handoffs, chasing Jamal Murray around? Will that mean more Jalen Clark or Terrence Shannon out there? How will they do defending Murray? If it does come to that, how would McDaniels do with more on-ball scoring opportunities? This is what Minnesota is going to have. And Denver is the favorite on the road for this game. And I think it's fair for them to be the favorite, given the fact that they have Nikola Jokic, still one of the best players in the world, and the Wolves don't have two of their starters, and they might not even have one of their best players in Io Dosunmu, who had 43 points to even win that game that Anthony Edwards got hurt and DiVincenzo got hurt. That's scary. But you still can't rule out Minnesota winning this game, because I do think they have other ways to overcome.
For sure. And earlier this week, we talked to Adam Mares over at Basketball Illuminati when we discussed this series. Amin said this series was over. There's no way that the Timberwolves are going to hold on to this one and it's going to be Denver all the way. And I was just like, I don't know, man. Like the Naz Reid, Julius Randle, and Rudy Gobert, even without Dosunmu, we still haven't seen them just go like complete bully ball and go against Jokic without Aaron Gordon. And I feel like that is going to be the upper hand, the card that they pull in this game, that with Dosunmu limited or out completely, I feel like the Minnesota chances are much higher than some people are giving them.
Rockets, Pistons, Sixers, Nuggets are all now down 3-2, coming back from 3-0 or 3-1. How many game sevens do we get?
Oh, I think we're going to get a game seven in the Rockets series. I think we're going to get a game seven in the Detroit series. I think we're going to get three game sevens. I'll throw in Denver in that one as well. I think Boston probably closes this out. What do you think?
I think the Rockets, Lakers ends in six. I think Pistons force a game seven. I think Celtics finish off the Sixers in game six. I think Nuggets force a game seven. That's what I'm feeling. But hey, who knows? Who knows with these? Like, all I know is that I'm very happy these teams have made the first round fun, because boy, like, it's kind of crazy that we have a potential 3-0 comeback for the first time in NBA history. Three 3-1 comebacks potentially happening as well. And even with the series that were 2-2, these are pretty good series as well. Cleveland beat Toronto in game five to go up 3-2, 125-120. This is the highest scoring game of the series after it was a pretty ugly series overall. The Raptors led by 12 in the first half. I posted on X. I said, oh, the Cavs look ready for Cancun. They look done. And then boom. Everybody came to life. Mitchell made some plays. Evan Mobley hit some threes. Dennis Schroeder came up big, playoff player in the fourth quarter, and it was also key to this game. You know, Toronto scores 120. They're getting buckets. But at the end of the second half, Scotty Barnes hurt his leg. And Brandon Ingram also was left with injury as well, by the way. But the Scotty Barnes injury especially, he had 14 points, 8 assists, and 2 boards leading up to that injury late in the second quarter. It looked like he was going to have an unbelievable, memorable game for the Raptors. And then in the second half, he had only 3 points and 3 assists and did not look anywhere near as explosive with the ball in his hands or even defensively as he did in the first half of that game. And so for Toronto, they've shown a lot this series, but at the end of the day, I think the Cleveland talent advantage is winning out here, especially with Scotty Barnes suffering that injury and not looking like his total self, and with Brandon Ingram getting knocked out midway through the game as well.
I mean, the Cleveland Cavaliers were begging to choke this game away, begging at down the stretch. But without Scotty Barnes at 100% and without Brandon Ingram, the Toronto Raptors just couldn't generate enough offense to make the Cavs pay for what was anemic offense down the stretch. At the 3:43 mark, Dennis Schroeder hit that shot in the paint. After that, the Cavs went 0-for-6 from the floor. And then when James Harden and Evan Mobley went to the line, they went 1-for-4 from the charity stripe down the stretch. They scored 1 point. This was the Cavs were doing everything in their power to choke this game away on their home floor. And it's just without those guys at 100%, the Raptors just didn't have enough horses to complete that comeback, because this Cavs team, it is so Jekyll and Hyde when you watch them. You mentioned it where you thought, oh yeah, they're going for Cancun. They're not going to Cancun. And then down the stretch, it looked like they were about to choke this one and let them go to Toronto to close this out and take it back to Toronto with a chance to win this series. But the Cavs are so...
At the end, Tom, it was like, wait a minute. I have my plane tickets, my hotel booked. Wait a minute. We're going to lose this lead. That's what it felt like. Just reverting back to that.
Is there any other single-use playoff player that better than Dennis Schroeder? Dennis Schroeder has bounced from 5 teams in the last 2 years, and the Cavs, they got another one from Dennis Schroeder. He's on his 11th team, and down the stretch, he was kind of like the stabilizer for the Cavs. It's weird to say when you got Donovan Mitchell, who's gimpy right now, and James Harden, who's 37 years old. But Dennis Schroeder, have we ever seen a guy who's just like plug and play for various playoff teams? I can't recall another player. Like, Ish Smith is in his own category. Dennis Schroeder has been on how many different playoff teams on these single use 1 year and we're done with you? And now the Cavs are stepping up right now.
It's absolutely crazy what Dennis Schroeder continues to do. Single use playoff player. That's a great, great phrase and a great way to put it. The Knicks have game 6 tonight, first game on Thursday night, 7 p.m. They're up 3-2 on the Atlanta Hawks. I think with New York in this series, Mike Brown, Sam Amick reported over at The Athletic after, I think it was game four, if I remember correctly, that Brown and Kenny Atkinson or Nick Nurse are coaches on the hot seat. And Amick had said how Brown, even if the Knicks make the finals, that might not be enough. And on Monday's show, I was like, the timing of this seems kind of strange, because he made some pretty good adjustments in game four. Karl-Anthony Towns, they get the ball in his hands, move him to the middle of the floor, a 10 assist, picking apart the Hawks defense. And Brunson, they moved him off ball. They had him setting screens, and OG Anunoby was flaring out for the corner three. And then in game five, similar thing. You know, Brunson was getting opportunities off ball. Cat was dominating from the middle. They switched up how they were defending CJ McCollum. But some of those adjustments, it's like, wait a minute. Why did this wait until midway through the middle of the first round of the playoffs when Cat should have been playing like this back in October? So I get the pressure in some ways. However, Tom, I do think with where we are today in the middle of this series, it does feel like the Knicks have fixed themselves against the Hawks, at least from my seat watching this New York team. Would you agree with that based off of the way the series has developed?
Totally. I think this is the biggest development in the league over the last week without injuries. We're putting aside injury talk and all the different variables there. The fact that Karl-Anthony Towns is now operating as a hub in the top of the key and on the elbow, running this flex motion offense. We ran this in high school. This was our offense in high school, was just getting the ball into the elbow and then run off ball screens. It's a very basic offense, but it also makes Jalen Brunson off the ball and more of a weapon that he can come in clutch time and have a little bit more juice down the stretch. And Karl-Anthony Towns has a lot more playmaking ability than I think he got credit for coming into the New York Knicks, and he's utilizing it. And Mike Brown, credit to him for making this adjustment. We talked about it on the Big Number, primarily for most of the show, is how big the development this is for the Knicks, that Karl-Anthony Towns is able to relieve some of that stress and that stamina for Jalen Brunson. Remind you, Kev, Jalen Brunson had 8 baskets at the rim in Game 5, which is the most he's ever had in the playoffs, and a lot of that was because he was playing off the ball. So much better offense when you got Jalen Brunson, paging Tom Thibodeau here, off the ball and not having to exhaust himself running the offense by himself. And it took this long for Mike Brown to do it, but I got the player tracking data finally, the dribble data that the NBA sends out. We got it for Game 5 and for Game 4 in this series. Games 1-3, Jalen Brunson, Kev, had averaged, right here, 573 dribbles per game in games 1-3. And then in the last 2 games, he sliced 100 dribbles per game away from that, 115 on average in games 4 and 5. And he was awesome in those games. So it is a revelation here that a lot of us were clamoring for last year down the stretch, is how much can you depend on Jalen Brunson, as good as he is, in order to win the championship and bring home the Larry O'B to Madison Square Garden? I think they got to get more dynamic offense, and it came true in games 4 and 5, getting Jalen Brunson off the ball, OG Anunoby getting those passes from Kat. We've had more assists to Jalen Brunson from Karl-Anthony Towns in that game 4 and 5 than we saw in the entire postseason last year. Just 2 games, the last 2 games. Crazy. Kat to Brunson, more assists from them than we had in the entire 18-game postseason last year. And that is a huge, huge development.
That's hard to fathom. It is hard to fathom, and yet it makes total sense. I mean, it's like, oh yeah, well, of course, considering the way in which they played games 4 and 5. What took so long, Tibbs and then Mike Brown? But hey, we're finally here. And look, I think the story flipped, right? The beginning of the series, it was all about CJ McCollum, another dominant series by CJ McCollum. He's a playoff player, just like he was in Portland. Well, that's flipped completely. Now it's become a Brunson series. He is now outplaying CJ McCollum. And I think, again, credit to the Knicks defense and Mike Brown for an adjustment there. Earlier in the series, they were playing more drop coverage, switching a little bit more often against CJ McCollum. Later in the series, they're blitzing more. They're showing more. They're more aggressive, getting the ball out of his hands more frequently. Hart's defending him more often. Kat on switches looks more comfortable. Kat has been great defensively as well, whether he's on ball or off ball. The Knicks, like, they are a team, what, 4.5 weeks ago, the conversation about them was like, hey, this team doesn't seem to have the joy anymore. It seems like that's back. It seems like the Knicks have fixed themselves. And obviously, like, that might just be a little, you know, blip here against an inferior Hawks team, but I like what I'm seeing from the Knicks. I feel pretty good about where they're looking heading into round 2, assuming they can finish off the Hawks here. And for Atlanta, Tom, like, they just, some of their holes have been exploited. The fact New York is able to sag off of Dyson Daniels and feel comfortable with him shooting, the Hawks put Daniels on Kat, and then they're just dominating the boards because of the size advantage. And then Kuminga, you're happy with him taking spot up 3-pointers. There's just a lot of holes on this Hawks roster where, hey, like, you're happy with where you are and the development this year, but there's a lot to solve in Atlanta to, I think, win this series and then take the next step next season, regardless of what happens in game 6 and possibly game 7 against New York.
Yeah, they just don't have the size to compete at the highest level against the Knicks. And I think also, as good as Okongwu, and I've been a huge fan on the bandwagon of Okongwu since he came into the league, love the way he plays, but the size advantage that Cat has shown, not just in the paint, but outside the paint, the ability for Cat to just kind of palm the ball and make these passes above Okongwu, who gets real low on that. And I wonder if you're going to see an adjustment. They try to just size up a little bit more when he's in that flex offense, because it just seems like, man, Karl Anthony Towns is so big. And against Embiid or Keita, is he able to command that sort of size advantage? Against this Atlanta Hawks team, he's been able to figure that out. And I'm surprised it took this long for the Knicks to assert themselves in the size advantage. But now you're really seeing in the last couple games.
I think, like Scott of Gray said in the live YouTube chat, the Hawks are just too small. Quinn Snyder's an excellent coach, by the way. These flaws will get addressed in the offseason. And I would agree with what was said there by Scott with Atlanta. So we'll see what happens in game six tonight. We'll see if they can extend it. There are some completed series. The Thunder swept the Suns 4-0. The Spurs finished off your Portland Trailblazers 4-1. So both of those teams are advancing. They get a little bit of rest here. OKC, I mean, I think with San Antonio, it's obvious. You'd rather face the Wolves without Anthony Edwards or with a limited Anthony Edwards. With the Thunder, would you rather face the Rockets or the Lakers?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think right now it's got to be the Houston Rockets. I just feel like the ball handling and the offense, I think they would just really bully Houston. Sorry, if they were facing Houston, I would imagine they were going to bully Reed Sheppard and the youth on that side. I just don't think they have the offense to sustain against the dogs of OKC. I think would just tear them up. On the Lakers side, if Luka and Reeves, we already have Reeves, but if Luka comes back, I don't think they want anything to do with Luka and LeBron and Austin Reeves. As good as they looked in the second half of the season, where a lot of their on-court issues, when they're playing together, they seem to solve them. So for me, if I'm OKC, I'm praying that you see the Houston Rockets make history here, coming back from down 0-3 and beating the Los Angeles Lakers. Because with Luka coming back, and Austin Reeves already back, I think they just have a higher ceiling than the Rockets do.
I think if it's Houston, you're going to see OKC 8-0 heading into the Western Conference Finals. And if it's the Lakers, maybe 8-1. Maybe Luka has one dominant game, Reeves has one dominant game. But even then, 8-0 wouldn't surprise me for Oklahoma City. I mean, because the Lakers, Tom, like, obviously there's no Luka, and Reeves just came back for his first game. But as we talked about earlier in the show, if Houston's defense is giving you that much trouble with their ball pressure, can you imagine what it's going to look like against Oklahoma City? Like, that could get ugly. It could get ugly. They need Luka back. That's for sure, to have any hope at all, even just making it competitive. Otherwise, it's going to be a blowout every single game, just like it was between Phoenix and Oklahoma City. And the crazy thing for the Thunder is they're doing this with Jalen Williams out again with the hamstring injury. I don't think they need Jalen Williams to advance through round two, regardless of the opponent. I do think OKC needs to worry about getting him healthy for the Western Conference Finals, though, against San Antonio, given the amount of ways the Spurs are showing that they can win games. That series against Portland, Tom, Wemby, game one, 35 points, it's his night. Game three, that win, it's without Wemby. Castle has 33. Harper has 27. Scoot Henderson talks trash and it activates something in Dylan Harper's brain. Game four, Harper has only 3 points. Not a good game for him. Castle only 16. Fox has 28. Like, he's the guy who steps up. And then game five, Wemby took 7 shots. Fox has 21. Champagne has 19. He hits 5 threes. Harper has 17. The Spurs are showing that they can beat you in different ways with different players, different approaches. And that's why they're ready for Oklahoma City. You've been right all year long about this Spurs team, and they're answering those questions in the middle of the playoffs against a Portland defense that was number 3 in defensive rating in the second half of the year. They weren't facing some slouches. They were facing a really good defense and still winning games in different ways.
Kev, I caught hell from the Blazers fans when I picked San Antonio to win it all this year, because it just felt like, you know, wait, you're on our broadcast and you're picking the Spurs to win it all? And I made that pick before I knew that the Blazers were going to face the Spurs. So just want to caveat that. But I think this is the Spurs year. 100%, I think this is the Spurs year.
And then you switched to Portland, right?
No. Yeah, I think I said Spurs in six. It ended up being Spurs in five, and it could have been Spurs in four if Wemby played in that one. Look, Kev, I said it before, and I'll say it again. There's something about the San Antonio Spurs team. When you have the Jalen Williams injury on the other side, you have the dominance of the Spurs both ends of the floor. Victor Wembanyama doesn't look scared at all in his playoff debut. In fact, I would argue that he looks more excited about this postseason and more ready for this postseason than just about any player we've seen in the playoff field. He doesn't look scared with the lights or the moment or the stage. Now, it's the first round. It's against a team, the Blazers, with a lot of young guys in their first playoff series as well. It's going to be different when you're going against Jokic or when you're going against Rudy Gobert and Julius Randle and potentially Anthony Edwards if he would come back in that series late. But I'm telling you, man, the both ends of the floor, the way that the Spurs look so composed and getting everything that they want, and Julian Champagne, the fact that this guy is able to shoot the lights out on this San Antonio Spurs team that was so desperate for three-point shooting, I just don't think they have any holes. The Spurs have no holes. They're healthy, and against OKC in the regular season, dominated that matchup. And with OKC having the injuries, I feel better than ever about the fact that I picked the Spurs winning this whole entire thing. It just feels like it. Look, there hasn't been a team that has done this, right? First year that they've had no playoff experience. Wemby at 22 years old, the leader of this team. This isn't magic on the Lakers, right? Because there was Hall of Famers and All-Stars when he came to that Lakers team and won it all in his rookie season. This is different when you got Victor Wembanyama being the face and the best player by far on the team. I just think seven of the last 7 years, we've had a new champion, and I think we're going to see another one with the San Antonio Spurs. Even if it's early, it's just been unbelievable how good he's been and the Spurs as a team.
We very well might. And Julian Champagne, just a little fun fact, not for Sixers fans, though. Champagne was waived in February 2023 by the Philadelphia 76ers to duck the tax and to free up a roster spot for Mac McClung to participate in the dunk contest wearing a Sixers jersey.
Can't make it up, dude.
And now
can't make it up.
Oh man, I mean, there's some pretty good former Sixers still out there in the playoffs. Isaiah Joe, McCain, among others. Philly's got a way to find these kind of diamonds in the rough. It's just they don't keep them, unfortunately, for ownership reasons. Speaking of owners, yeah. Blazers offseason priorities here. Right now, so Tom Dunnan is in the news, technically your new boss, Tom, for lowballing Tiago Splitter, cutting costs, not having, you know, t-shirts and all that. It's interesting. I don't follow hockey that closely at all. I'm very much, I'll watch the Stanley Cup. I'll turn it on if there's no NBA games on that night. And, you know, it's fun. I like playoff hockey, but I don't follow the NHL too much. I had no idea until he bought the Blazers who Tom Dundon was. But you do a little research, it's pretty fascinating. Like 8 years ago when he bought the Carolina Hurricanes, it was pretty much all the same types of stories about Tom Dundon that you see right now involving the Portland Trail Blazers. Cheaping out on hiring a coach, cutting costs in the front office, this and that. Is this good for the Hurricanes? Well, they hired Ron Brind'Amour, who was the captain of their title team in the mid-2000s, as a cheapest coach in the NHL. He's led the Hurricanes to 8 straight years in the playoffs. He's now being paid a more normal rate for a head coach in the NHL. And the Hurricanes just swept in the first round. They're the favorites in the East to go to the Stanley Cup Finals. So 8 straight years of the playoffs for the Carolina Hurricanes with a new owner who did all the same things he's doing now in Portland with the Hurricanes. So I think for all the negativity right now involving Dundon, fair, you can not like it if you want. You can prefer the Steve Ballmer approach where he spends and spends and spends and spends and it still doesn't lead to great success. I'm willing to give Dundon a chance with these kind of the anti-Ballmer philosophy here. Because who knows? It's working in the NHL. Maybe it'll work here in the NBA as well. It's been very successful there with Brendan Moore as the head coach of the Hurricanes. Who's the equivalent for the Blazers? Dame, player coach? Bring him on, Tom, right?
No. Dame, player coach, that would be something.
Why not? Hey, why not? Well, come on.
I think Tiago Splitter has done an amazing job with the Blazers in keeping everything together, the way that they defended down the stretch in the season, the blossoming of Denny Avdija, and keeping everyone pulling in the same direction. Not an easy job for Tiago Splitter. And I will say this also, like the Denny Avdija resurgence and the contract that he's on, with Damian Lillard coming into the picture next year, things get very interesting in Portland because the team desperately needs three-point shooting, and you potentially have one of the greatest three-point shooters ever to pick up a basketball returning to the fold. And it is going to be Tiago Splitter or whomever is at the helm for the Blazers to figure out how to get those two guys to be on the same page in terms of the playing style. Because Denny, they call him Turbo for a reason. He wants to get up and down the floor and play at a high pace. And Damian Lillard has typically, as the face of the franchise, not played at that up-tempo style. In fact, very much the opposite, is more methodical and playing a little bit more calculated in the half court. They're going to need a lot of that because when the game slowed down in the half court and when Denny was trying to create things out of thin air, things were tough in this series against the San Antonio Spurs. It's an obscenely difficult matchup for any offense, but you saw that they need some three-point spacing, and Vic Krejci coming in late in game five and trying to boost that offense. It's exactly what I was hoping for when they acquired him at the deadline from Atlanta, how desperate the Blazers need three-point shooting, and then potentially getting Damian Lillard back. I don't know about a player coach like you suggested, but I will say that Denny Avdija, he's a special player. And in that series, you could see that he is definitely all NBA, all-star talent. It's just a question now of how do they pair him with the right star to get this team to the next level. And that's what's going to be most interesting for the Blazers this offseason, and whether Damian Lillard is that missing piece for them in the short term.
One thing I know, I'm not trading for Giannis. If I'm Portland, I know it was reported earlier in the week, oh, the Blazers could prepare an offer. I think it was Bill Oram that had reported that. I don't like the Giannis-Denny Avdija pairing. I would not go in that direction. I'd want to use my picks elsewhere if I'm the Blazers with more shooting, better balance next to Denny. I think that's the way I would go if I'm the Portland Trailblazers. And I don't think they necessarily need to rush it either. I think there's plenty of reason to play this patiently, though. And we'll talk about, lottery stuff in a second when it comes to the value of future picks, because I think that's also important in the context of the Phoenix Suns here. They're eliminated 4-0 in the first round by Oklahoma City. They're just, OKC's just on another level from the Suns, multiple other levels. Phoenix entering this offseason, a lot of their guys are under contract for next year. Mark Williams will be a free agent. Jordan Goodwin, who is excellent defensively this year, will be a free agent. Colin Gillespie will be a free agent as well. I'd love for them to bring back Gillespie. Mark Williams, I'm less certain. I thought Kaman Malawat showed a lot down the stretch of the season for the Phoenix Suns, and I want to see more of him next season. Maybe he can shoot the three a little bit. Maybe he's even more of an upgrade on the defensive end of the floor as well. Where I'm very interested with Phoenix is it's not like they don't have the most picks to trade, to dangle in any situation for any star. But with the new lottery rules that we'll hit on in a second, I do think it puts a lot of teams into interesting positions because now picks in the middle could have more value. And so there could be more incentive for teams to either A, decide, oh, we'll trade our pick, a lot of picks for a star level player and pair that guy with Devin Booker, or the other side, there could be teams that are saying, hey, you guys aren't close Booker is 30 years old. He's making $57 million this year. He'll be making $70 million when he's 33 years old. Here's our offer of 5 first-round picks, this young guy, an expiring salary. That's the number one thing I'm very intrigued by entering this offseason involving the Phoenix Suns is, would they listen? Would they listen with the changing value of future first-round draft picks for their star and Devin Booker, given how far away they are from actually being a contender? I think it's something worth thinking about, Tom. I do. I do think it is for Phoenix. And I know Suns fans probably don't want to hear that, but it's just the way I honestly feel about their situation this offseason.
$250 million are being owed to Devin Booker in the next 4 years.
And he's not a top 10 player. He's like 11 to 18 or something in that range.
I think you're going to see Devin Booker's name and his contract on some of these worst contracts in the NBA list soon, because he's just not that level of player. And with all of the money and the age factor, when he's the A1 guy on your offense, what is your ceiling? And he's not a defensive player of the year or a guy who's going to give you something on that end of the floor. So if you're paying this guy super max money, maximum dollars, $70 million in a few years, you got to make sure that he's going to be the impact with the apron rules that we're seeing. It's going to be tough to have Devin Booker weighing your books like that if he, no pun intended, if he's at this stage where he's going to be 30 years old next year. You're going to see a team that is going to look at it. I like the idea of Devin Booker on our squad, but the potential for this to be a Joel Embiid or a Paul George type contract on the books is very real. And there's one team I think that you could look at and say, well, don't worry about it. He's our guy. We'll figure this out. And it's Phoenix.
Can I guess? Can I guess? I thought you were going to say a different team.
Are you going to say the Knicks? I don't know.
No, I was going to say the Detroit Pistons. If they lose to Orlando, Booker helps solve your need for secondary creation, and he gives you more shooting off ball as well. I think Pistons. And plus, he's a Michigan native, too. So I was thinking you were going to say Detroit.
Well, there's that. I was thinking the Knicks, because to reunite with Leon Rose and Karl Anthony Towns.
That's possible,
and,
too.
But the contract that would be insane. I don't even know what the deal would look like from the
Bridges, and I don't know. It's really hard to work that one out, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. But like Detroit makes some sense. But I also think like it feels like to me, Devin Booker is in the same type of area as Kevin Durant, where he has the reputation of a great three-point shooter, but he doesn't have the volume in today's three-point heavy era. He's just not the same floor spacer that I think Detroit, yes, on ball creator, but at that price, it's going to be tough for Detroit to put in the deal to make that happen. So I think for Phoenix, you've got to figure out a way to get more out of Devin Booker, because I think the price tag that he has, where over the next 4 years, he's making, next season, he'll be making 57, the following year, 61, 64, and 70 million in 2029, 30. And we know Matt Ishbia does not care for the draft. He does not. The one thing we know about the Phoenix front office recently is they do not value the draft. Maybe that's changing. We saw Malawach and that pick go through. And of course, Iguodala, when you have guys, Ryan Dunn, also young guys, but traditionally they've been giving away picks as much as they can. And I think this is going to be a really tough future for the Phoenix Suns, because I think they maxed out this year, but I just don't know Devin Booker and Dylan Brooks as a core. What's the ceiling on that? It feels like where they're at right now is the ceiling with Jalen Green. I'm not a believer in Jalen Green going forward. And I do think Phoenix has kind of like this ceiling of a 45 win team, 50 win team. And I just don't know how they break that ceiling.
I'm with you there. I mean, I think the Suns are truly facing a crossroads here, and they could go in either direction. I just think the more reasonable direction is opening the door to offers for Devin Booker. We'll be right back. The NBA earlier this week proposed their new lottery reform idea, which they're calling the 3-2-1 lottery system. And what the system will do as proposed. It could change before the May 28th owner vote, but it expands the pool of lottery teams from 14 to 16. That means there's going to be play-in teams involved here. The loser of the 7-8 series in each play-in round on the West and the East will be added to it. It flattens the chances of the top overall pick. Lottery balls are going to be put into tiers. The bottom three teams will enter a draft relegation zone in which they'll have less lottery balls than the teams in the 4-10 range. Teams additionally cannot pick in the number one in back-to-back years and cannot get top five picks in three consecutive years. Now, just to look at the odds, the distribution with the way this is proposed by the league with the 3-2-1 system, the rest of the non-playing team, so the non-three worst records, they're gonna get three lottery balls. The three worst records are only gonna get two. This is being done to incentivize winning, escaping the bottom three. Rather than trying to lose games to stay in the bottom three, you'll be punished with only two lottery balls and a 5.4% chance of getting the number one pick. The rest of the non-playing teams, the other seven, would have an 8.1% chance at the number one pick with their three lottery balls. The ninth and 10th play-in seeds in each conference would have two lottery balls, also a 5.4% chance. And then the losers of the 7-8 play-in game would have a 2.7% chance with their one lottery ball in this scenario. And just one last thing, Tom, before I throw to you for your opinion, let's look at a graphic here comparing the current odds to the new odds involving the NBA draft lottery. Just visually for the people watching on YouTube, the difference between what we had currently and what it could be moving forward starting in the 2027 draft, where the 4th-10th slots are the best place to be. That's where there's the biggest increase in draft lottery odds, as well as at the bottom where these teams in the 11-16 range would have higher percent odds than they currently do as well. If the three worst spots would go from 14% to 5.4%. Tom, readers of me saw on Yahoo Sports know I like this. Listeners know from a couple of weeks ago when I reported this, the draft relegation zone concept, they know that I was in favor of that then. So I think it's fairly obvious to say that I am currently in favor of this. There are flaws, but before we get into some of that, some of the pros and cons I see, I am curious, what are your thoughts on this new anti-tanking lottery proposal?
Yeah, I think teams are going to be campaigning for this to end in 3 years. I think they sunsetted this for a reason. Like, they have the provision to have this sunset in 2029 ahead of the CBA expiring. And to me, that says a lot, is that while this proposal would be implemented for the 2027 draft, they already have a provision in there to scrap it and revisit it in 2029. So it's only a 3-year trial at this point. And I can understand why. This is pretty radical, Kev. The idea that we're going to expand the lottery to play-in teams and playoff teams, where the loser of the 7-8 game would have an incentive to throw that game potentially, still make the playoffs, and have a pretty solid chance at getting the number one overall pick, I think is a bridge too far. Kev, I think they've swung from anti-tanking into anti-competitive balance. And if you go to these simulators now, we did this on the big number yesterday, so you could go check this out, is that if you go and use these simulators, you can see how random this is going to be. And I think the biggest thing the NBA is going to fight, and you might disagree on this, and I think reasonable people can disagree on this, but the NBA has a trust issue right now with the gambling stuff that's happening and the indictments and the gambling arrests that we're seeing from both players and coaches, that we're going to hear so much more about how the NBA is rigging this system for the Golden State Warriors to win the number one pick in the NBA draft. Of course, they're giving the most valuable franchise the number one overall pick. Or if the Knicks have a down year, Jalen Brunson gets hurt, and suddenly they're the 8 seed and they get the number one overall pick. These are scenarios that seem so far-fetched in the current draft lottery rules, but become a very real circumstance in this new system where you're going to see flattened odds, essentially. I know we showed the graphic earlier on what it looks like, the distribution of odds. It's essentially flat 1 through 16. And I just think the NBA has to prepare themselves for fans who are already in the most NBA is rigged. They're the most already skeptical and cynical fan base of any of the four major sports. We're now introducing a situation where 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 seeds could potentially win number one, number two, number three picks. And I just think this invites so much more negative energy around the league. And I think it's swung way too far. I would say don't involve playoff teams in this draft lottery. I know you think it's a good idea to expand the lottery field from potentially 16, 18, 22 team. I just think it will get really ugly, the conversation around the league. And it doesn't seem that way now. But as we saw with Cooper Flagg going number one and with the Atlanta Hawks jumping up to number one, I just feel like it's going to get the conversation around the league is going to get extremely toxic in the next few years to come.
Did James Worthy going number one to the Lakers in the early 80s kill basketball?
No, I don't think it did. No. But I do think that when you're talking about the reputation of the league and people thinking, and whether this is true or not, I'm not saying the NBA does rig this, but the NBA has a very real PR problem on this front, especially with the court issues that they had. It's different than it was when James Worthy went number one overall. I get it from the standpoint of having a stacked deck and having like juggernauts and dynasties in the NBA is good for business. But what isn't good for business is the perception that the commissioner is rigging this or the NBA is rigging this. We've already heard David Stern say, my ideal finals matchup is Lakers versus the Lakers. We already know that those jokes pre-pro gambling era, when they legalized gambling at the federal level, when they lifted the ban on gambling, that joke was ha ha ha. Not anymore, Kev.
Well, I mean, look, to your point, there's negative energy either way. There's negative energy now with a third of the league trying to lose games, as you talked about all year long with the A League versus the B League. That's the way it was all year long with teams trying to lose games. This, at least, in my opinion, incentivizes winning. I think with the flattened odds you see on screen, if you're watching on YouTube, just for the audio listeners to read through a little bit, but we talked about the number one odds earlier. The odds of getting into the top three for the three worst records and the 9 and 10 play-in seeds is 16%. It's 24% for the seven other non-play-in teams. It's 8% for the losers of the 7 versus 8 play-in to get into the top 10 in the draft lottery, because all 16 picks are selected, for what it's worth. The three worst records, furthest they can fall is number 12, but all 16 picks would be selected. For a top 10 pick, the three worst records would have a 61% chance. The seven other non-play-in teams would have a 73% chance. The 9 and 10 play-in seeds would have a 59% chance. The two losers of the 7 versus 8 play-in would have a 35% chance. So that just gives you an idea of the odds with the amount of randomness there will be, to Tom's point. I think you can look at this in two ways. You can look at this as a negative, that, like you said, there will be some good teams that could move into the top three. If it were this year, you could have a situation where the Magic end up with the number three pick and they can draft Cam Boozer. But even though they were in the playoffs, and even though they might win in the first round because they were a team that lost in the 7-8 play-in, ending up in the 8 seed, I think that's a flaw. I do think that's something where the perception of a team trying to either lose that 7-8 or as a 5-6 seed falling into the 7-8, knowing the possibility of getting up lottery odds and still being in the playoffs, there's that possibility. But on the other side, Tom, I'm somebody who, my favorite lottery reform idea is the Mike Zarin wheel, where it is a rotating wheel with different odds or every single year. My revised edition of that was, instead of a wheel of a designated draft slot, as Zarin had talked about, is more of a lottery version of the wheel, where it's like you get designated odds every year. That's my favorite version. So I like randomness. I think randomness makes it more interesting because you completely divorce standings from lottery odds. I'm that extremist. And clearly the league isn't going that far. But this is radical. This is still radical. It
you
is.
You think that's extreme? And getting rid of the draft is extreme, and that's where I'm at. Yeah, so, I mean,
yeah, you are.
I think we get rid of the lottery and the commissioner conversation altogether and just say it's bad for the sport. The lottery is bad for the sport and just go to the free agency model for rookies. But I digress. Go ahead.
That's why there's going to be the 3-year trial, Tom, because I think in 2029, they're going to be in a position. We did this, whatever it is that they decide on voting on May 28th. In 3 years from now, in 2029, that's when I think you could see things tied to the collective bargaining agreement, more negotiations, really trying to iron this out. Is there ways that we can adjust the salary cap and money to wins and placement in the league and standings? That's where I think you could see more of those radical ideas. Maybe we should just get rid of the draft. That could be more of a discussion then. But as of now, from the sources I've talked to around the league, it does seem like the league is honing in on something in this spirit, but it is not exact. They're like, this is not what they're going to vote on May 28th. There may be revisions, differences in the draft odds. Maybe they change the relegation zone to 2 teams instead of 1 team. Maybe they make it that let's remove the fact that you can't receive a top 5 pick 3 years in a row over maybe they change that. Maybe they allow what happened to the Spurs and the Pistons and other teams. This is not exactly what's going to be voted on, is my point. But it's pretty close to, I think, the concept that they are aiming for and what they like. And that's because they want to remove the incentive to bottom out, remove the race to the bottom, where you have these teams, the Wizards with 17 wins, the Pacers with 19 wins, where the Wizards trade for Anthony Davis and they trade for Trae Young, and they put them on ice. And not only that, they started giving less minutes to their best young players. Where the Grizzlies, they pick up Ryan Rupaire. He has a 30-point triple-double in April. The next day they send him down to the G League because they're worried him helping him win games. The Jazz, of course, were fine. The Pacers, of course, were fine. Carlisle was tanking in October. This like Carlisle had a masterful tanking season. The Pacers are not a 30-win worst team without Halliburton. The Pacers tanked harder than anybody this year by playing lineups with no ball handlers, Carlisle not calling timeouts. It is ugly the way it is with the tanking right now. And with the relegation zone, to remove that incentive to be all the way at the bottom, and it rewards teams with competent rosters. You're going to see the Wizards playing Anthony Davis and Trae Young, trying to get out of the bottom three, playing competitive basketball, leading to not like a 60-win team facing a team, and you know it's over by halftime. You're going to see more competitive games. That's what the league hopes. That's what the league hopes with the randomness in the draft. And that's personally where I land too, and where I've long felt about the draft for a decade plus. I've felt that way. I've felt that way based on the blogger at Celtics Blog when I wrote about when I riffed off of Zarin's idea then and came up with the lottery wheel. It's the way I still feel now. I like the idea, Tom. I understand why a lot of people hate it. I am a little surprised that people hate it to the extreme that we're seeing on social media, though. It's like really 99% people seem to hate it right now, at least on X. Thread seems to like bit more. I'm noticing.
Yeah, Kev, I think you were spot on last week when you reported this, that the draft relegation zone is where you want to see to eliminate the worst of this. I think the NBA did well to get rid of the outrageous tanking. I just think it goes too far into the randomness, and I want to get rid of those play-in teams and playoff teams that could get those high odds of the number one overall pick. I think they did a good job of getting rid of the tanking. It's just I think they went way too far in that other end of the spectrum.
Tom, that's where my concerns are. Like I think for the NBA, you have, like I alluded to earlier, the 5-6 aspect where those teams suddenly have incentive to possibly fall to 7 or 8, considering that the team that loses 7 or 8 gets a chance. Like, well, the Orlando Magic, they have a chance to win in the first round and get a 2.7% chance of the number one pick. And not only that, like, they would also have a 35% chance at a top 10 pick, a 15% chance at a top 5 pick. Those are pretty good odds if you lose the 7-8. I think this is like pretty good reason to want to lose that game. The NBA is hoping that, like, that we haven't seen that really too much yet, and they are also having the ability to punish teams more, removing a lottery ball, changing a draft position, more of a range with punishments. I think it would be pretty easy to snuff out teams that are doing that, but at the same time, like, teams can do it in subtle ways that are really hard to police, where it's like, what's the difference between a bad decision by a coach versus
Doug Christie's
losing purposely? Yeah, right? Like, yeah, like, what's the difference? It's like, it's hard to tell. There's a lot of gray area there, and that's where I have concerns there, and that's why I also favored extending to 22 teams with the first round losers, because nobody's going to lose a first round series on purpose. Like, it's just not going to happen. A team is not going to lose a first round series on purpose. And you could also just kind of change those odds a little bit in a way where, like, it's not a lot of incentive. Maybe you don't even let those first round losers have the chance to move into the top X amount of picks. I think this has some flaws, and I do think if you're going to see anything change, maybe this is what it will be, addressing exactly the point you're talking about with that 7-8 flaw.
Yeah, I think it's too high. Like, right now, if the loser of 7-8, gets it, the draft lottery odds, the ping pong ball situation with this setup, it's the equivalent of a number 10 seed or a 10 slot right now. It's just a lot. 2.7% at getting number one overall is crazy for a number 8 seed. I feel like that's too high. I like the simplicity of one ball, two ball, three ball. But I do think that's one tweak I would make is not having any sort of doubt. Like, what we want is we want to watch games and not have the thought, are they trying to lose? And if there's a one thing that I think, besides the conversation, I think could get toxic around the draft lottery odds and the NBA rigging it, like the conversation with the frozen envelope. You thought that was loud? Just wait until in the social media era with the frozen envelope part two in something like this in this setup. I would say also, I feel like this cannibalizes the play-in tournament a little bit. We saw with the stratified NBA this year that you saw teams just say, yeah, we're not even going to try to get in the play-in tournament. We're just going to try to get into this bottom 10 area and maximize our chances to get in the top four or get the number one overall pick. I think with this setup, I think you would introduce teams that are just going to either not try in that 7-8 game, but in a subtle way. Like, there are ways to soft tank institutionally or at the coaching level or medical level that the NBA really struggled to police this year, where it's like a guy who's 60% to play in the 7-8 game, a star player, do you just sit him in that 7-8 game knowing you have another chance at home with that star player in that 9-10 winner game, and the loser of 7-8 plays the winner in 9-10, I think that is the worry I would have, is if people are watching that 7-8 matchup, the conversation is going to be, wait a minute, the winner of this gets blown out in the first round, but the loser of this also could get blown out, but they have a chance at number one. Yes. I just feel like you get rid of that conversation. And one of Adam Silver's greatest things, I think, in his tenure is giving this play-in tournament that excitement. And I think it takes the air completely out of this, of the play-in tournament. And you wonder if teams are even going to try in those play-in opportunities.
Well, again, Tom, this is why I bring it back to 22 teams. Because in that case, nobody's going to lose a first round series on purpose. It is not going to happen. You're not going to.
I think they wouldn't throw the series on purpose. I think if you get down 0-2, I think you see a lot of teams just packing it in. And that's different than throwing a series. I think you would see a lot fewer teams try to rally back from big deficits. I think that
like
would
we're seeing right now with all the 3-1s and the 3-0 comebacks, as we talked about at the top of the show. Like we're seeing right now.
I think you lose some of that. I think some teams will say, look, you know, on one hand, how many teams have come back from 0-3? Never happened. But on the other side, we could really improve our number one odds if we just pack it in and save Kevin Durant.
You're saying like suddenly, I don't think, for what it's worth, I don't think coaching staffs are going to do that. I don't think players are going to do that. What you're saying is that you think perhaps like the front office, the analytics department suddenly isn't giving as good of information. They're not giving as much advice. They're giving poor information to say, hey, they're not being helpful. They might be hurtful because this is where it comes from. Like tanking isn't a player thing. It is a front office thing. And sometimes that extends to coaches, sometimes not. That's where a lack of organizational alignment happens. You're saying that you can't let that enter the playoff conversation either, which I think is totally fair. And for what it's worth, I don't think it's going to extend to 22 teams. We already moved down from 18 teams in one of the original proposals down to 16 teams. I think if anything, we might move back down to 14 teams. I think that's a real possibility when it comes to the vote on May 28th, that it won't be 16 teams, that it could become 14 teams. I would not rule that out at all. Again, this is just a proposal. That's all it is. It is not the final plan. This is just another proposal, but it's getting closer to what they want to do. I think the relegation zone should stay, personally. You can haggle all you want on what the odds should be, what the penalty should be. I like, and how many teams should be in it. I like the relegation zone. I think it's an awesome idea. I think it makes games more competitive throughout the season. I think it would be a big win for the NBA. The play-in stuff is where I have my concerns. And I think everything you're saying is fair and accurate. And I look forward to seeing what they end up doing. I don't think it's going to be exactly this. I don't.
All right. So you outlined the tweaks you might make. One thing that I wanted to get your take on is the top five picks in 3 years, that rule, that provision that eliminates the possibility that, for example, the San Antonio Spurs would not be able to draft Dylan Harper in this last year's draft because they already had Stephon Castle and Victor Wembanyama in the top five. A list here for the listeners of players who would have been barred from being drafted if this rule was in place. I have, of course, the Spurs with Harper, the Pistons, Ausar Thompson, and Ron Holland. I don't think people are losing sleep about that. I don't think people are losing sleep of, you know, I think Mario Hezonja is also on this list of guys who would not have been allowed to be taken because he was top five for the third year in a row for this team. The Rockets, I misspoke. Reed Shepard, if he was in the draft because of a trade, I don't think the NBA would ban that from happening because that was with the Brooklyn pick that they got Reed Shepard. But Amen Thompson, Jalen Green and Jabari Smith, that trio would not have been possible under this provision. Now, I will say also the Cavs with Evan Mobley would not be able to get drafted. Lonzo Ball with the Lakers and Andrew Wiggins with the Cleveland Cavaliers when they jumped up to get number one overall pick, which is interesting when you think about this, Kev. Like the sliding doors of this all is LeBron James got two of his championships because those two guys, Andrew Wiggins and Lonzo Ball, were drafted, and then they were used in the trade to get Kevin Love and Anthony Davis for his respective teams. So it is interesting. Al Horford would not have been allowed to be drafted by the Atlanta Hawks. DeAndre Ayton with the Phoenix Suns because of Dragon Bender and Josh Jackson, wild to think about. So, like, Ben Simmons, Markelle Fultz, like the fact that they got in the lottery the number three pick. But that was with Sacramento. I'm just saying, if we retroactively did this and looked at the history of top five picks in three consecutive years, it does change things. And I wonder, Kevin, I actually kind of like this provision. Mm. I think it disincentivizes just multi-year tanking. But I also wonder if you will see this provision be submitted on the other side. Is I wonder if people, the GMs or the coaches or the front office folks, will say, hey, look, I'm okay with the draft relegation, But what if we cap it that you can't be in draft relegation for multiple, like 3 years in a row or something like that, that you're still, if you're truly bad and you have bad injury luck, you might be dipping into draft relegation zone for a year or 2 years, but not three. So what are your thoughts on this? Like, no back-to-back number one overall picks, no trios of top five pick provisions, because I actually think that's okay. I just wonder if they're going to insert maybe another amendment about the draft relegation zone.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I'm open to something like that for sure. I just think having the mechanism in place would be nice to have. Whatever shape it takes, I'd be cool with something like that, that you could be there 1 year, but you can't be there 2 years, right? I think that's reasonable. I think it's just easier just to keep it as is every year. Cleaner. You can't be there. Yeah, it's just cleaner. I mean, I've seen people say, oh, this is so confusing. Like, it's hard to understand. Yeah, I can understand why people, you can't just explain it the way you could, you know, when it was flat in odds in the past, or you can't explain it the way it was when it was 25% odds for number one. The worst teams get the best odds, and then it trickles down from there. You can't explain it as easy as the worst three teams all have 14% odds and everybody else trickles down from there. This is harder to explain with the 3-2-1 lottery system. And I'm somebody who, when they pitched their original three concepts a month and a half ago, I said, these are too complicated. I don't think this one's that hard to understand. I think it's a little bit harder to understand, but some of those other ones were very, you need a lot of elaboration to understand it. This one is 3-2-1. It's not that hard, but I think adding some stuff like that, I'm not against it. Maybe I've changed a little bit in the last month and a half or so since those original three concepts, where it's like, well, maybe it does need to be a little bit more complicated. Maybe it has to be.
I think maybe the best thing of this is how awesome it will be as a TV product. I think drafting.
Oh, it's gonna be incredible. Yes. Incredible.
Drafting 16 teams, pulling the balls and announcing the teams is going to be incredible theater. You know, because right now we only do the four team drawings. Now, if we do 16 teams and you see the Brooklyn Nets, they just picked number 12. Oh my God. And you're going to say, oh, wait, the Warriors are still on the board. And going from 4 teams to 16 potentially, I think would be amazing entertainment. I just worry about the backlash that you're going to hear from fan bases that everything's rigged. That's my look.
I think people are going to complain it's rigged no matter what the system is, unless you remove the draft entirely, Tom. So to your point, maybe someday you might get your wish, but it's not going to be in 2026 that you get your wish. Maybe in 3 years in 2029. But other than that, even then, people would find something to say about it being rigged, I'm sure, in some way, shape, or form. But for now, this seems to be along the lines of what the league is going for. And I like the randomness. I think it would be a lot of fun to have more fan bases interested in the draft, more teams with a chance to move up or down. It does not prevent bad teams from finding franchise-changing players. Every single year, there are good players found and scattered throughout the draft. And I just think about my upbringing as a fan, Tom, growing up a Celtics fan. The 06-07 season was personally one of my favorite years watching the Celtics. I loved watching the young guys grow and get better. Ryan Gomes and Rajon Rondo as a rookie and Leon Poe and all these young guys. And you know what? I was pissed off and sad going to bed when they won, because I wanted them to lose every night while getting better. Because I wanted the better draft odds for a chance to get Greg Oden or Kevin Durant. They lost out on draft lottery night, and they ended up getting the sixth pick, which they traded for Ray Allen. They later get Kevin Garnett, and they go and win a championship in 08. But I, even as a kid watching those teams, I felt like, boy, it's wrong to root for these kids to lose. I should be rooting for these kids to win. And then when I'm young in my career doing the mismatch with Chris Vernon, like, he always made fun of me for saying teams need to blow it up. That's because the odds were 25% for a chance to get a franchise changer, to get the best pick, to get the best trade value of a top pick. It was the right thing to do from a team building perspective. And even with the 14% flattened odds, I'm understanding why the Bulls have 8 point guards and why the Pacers are tanking their season away, because it's the right thing to do when AJ DeBonta and Cam Boozer and Caleb Olsen and Darren Peterson are out there. And then there's a bunch of other good prospects as well on the top end. It's the right thing to do. But it's the wrong thing when you're rooting for your team to lose. It's only the right thing because of the system in place. But it's the wrong thing for everybody involved. For tanking games and intentionally losing is bad for fans that are paying to go to games, bad for fans watching at home. It's bad for players and their development. When you're seeing good players for the Wizards play less, good young players getting sent to the G League, it's bad for veterans. It's bad for coaches and their development as coaches and as their job security. It is bad for the product, for the TV. Tanking is an abomination that the league needs to get rid of. Period. End of story. And this new potential lottery, 3-2-1 lottery system would accomplish that. Are there flaws? Yes. Is there other stuff they need to iron out over the next month before they vote on it on May 28th? Yes, absolutely they do. But to me, this is very clearly a step in the right direction and removing one of the biggest problems in the NBA, and that's tanking. And that's why I'm in favor at the end of the day.
Last thing before we go here, I wondered, how does this change long-term strategies for teams? Because swaps, I feel like, become way more valuable now because of the variance. So teams that have swaps on other really good teams or middling teams, I just feel like they're extra valuable now because they get a lot more interesting. It's not purely like what your record says you are. It's now we got 16 teams potentially in the lottery. And if you're a 50-win team, that this gets really interesting for some teams.
Tom, I think it's going to make trading even more fun. I've seen people say on social, and I disagree with it. People say, well, you've already made it hard in free agency with the new CBA, with the aprons and all that. You know, now you're making it harder and more random in the draft. Yeah, like in some ways, but you're also adding more randomness where you can move up, where you like now trades suddenly become even more interesting with the potential swaps you can have and the value of future first round picks, which is why I said with the Blazers or with the Suns, these teams, any team, it goes for literally all 30 teams. Now it's like, oh, wait a minute. We're the Miami Heat. Previously, our future picks didn't have a lot of value because teams know we're not going to bottom out. We're not a bottom out team. They didn't want our future picks. Well, now suddenly teams know you're a play-in team every year. You're in the middle a lot every year. Maybe suddenly those picks could become a number one pick or a number two pick. And that's where I look at this and I'm like, okay, well, trades could suddenly become more interesting. There could be more of them as well. And then also the draft, I think it would just be an unbelievable product with more randomness. Personally, I'm in favor of it. I understand why people are against it. But at the end of the day, stomping out tanking is, I think, number one priority here at the bottom. And that's what the league is trying to do. Tom, I mean, we're going to find out. We're going to find out what exactly the league is going to do here in the next couple of weeks. I look forward to finding out there. For listeners of the show, check out Yahoo Sports' coverage of the Miami Grand Prix starting this weekend. You can watch F1 practice and qualifying coverage for free on yahoosports.com and the Yahoo Sports app. Free practice one will begin at noon Eastern on Friday, May 1st. And then the qualifying will take place at 4 p.m. Eastern on Saturday, May 2nd. And then the Miami Grand Prix will stream on Apple TV at 4 p.m. Sunday, May 3rd. Check all that out at yahoosports.com/racing. Tom, have a good weekend, man. Enjoy the game. We'll see how many game sevens we get. I'm fired up. This first round is fun.
Thanks, Kev. Talk next week.
Have a good one, Tom. Thank you so much to Tom Haberstroh for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy and the team for producing us. Hope you enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the games. We'll be back again on Monday.